And here's an idea for anyone who needs a break from the news in these difficult times. Go to your computer and search for Fat Grizzly Bears. The annual competition to crown the fattest bear of Katmai National Park in Alaska wrapped up last week. My daughter proudly voted for the winner, bear number 747, a portly beast whose belly practically drags on the ground after stuffing himself with salmon to prepare for a long winter. The wildlife cam organization Explore.org described the winner this way.
He's one of the more dominant bears on the river, estimated to weigh more than 1,400 pounds. He's really, truly one of the largest bears on Earth and the most massive bear that I've ever seen in person.
Alaska is home to some 30,000 lumbering grizzly bears, but the population is far less stable in the lower 48. Numbers have rebounded because of protections from the Endangered Species Act, but that also means grizzlies are more likely to run into people. Bryce Andrews knows about this well. In his 2019 book, Down from the Mountain, Bryce writes about the summer he spent working at the edge of grizzly habitat for a conservation group in Montana's Mission Valley, trying to keep bears out of a farmer's cornfield. We spoke in April of that year. The way you describe the Mission Valley is incredibly vivid, and I was hoping you could read a passage for me. Do you have the book with you?
I do, yes.
Great. I'd love it if you could read the section where you describe this place in August, and the bears are feeding on the fruit trees that are dangerously close to civilization.
The grizzlies knocked hot-fleshed fruit to the ground. They sucked hard at the teats of summer, eating until their guts succumbed. Apples ripened everywhere. Bitterroot Macintoshes on leggy, untended trees, prized honeycrisps in orchards, crabapples on the banks of creeks and sloughs, and the feast became frenzy. The grizzlies fed in a series of massive inhalations, taking food the way a skin diver breathes before ducking beneath the waves. This was the rule of August. During the day, the valley belonged to humans. Tractors worked the fields, and children played carefree in the yards. People swam in shady eddies and picnicked beside the creeks. Life, even at the edge of the woods, went on as if ravenous creatures were not hiding among the trees.
It feels a little ominous, that tension between the animals and human beings. How did people deal with that there?
Well, I think different people deal with it in different ways. Certainly the people who are raising some of these crops, like corn, that grizzlies have learned to feed on, the tension exists for them not just as a philosophical feeling, but as a daily reality where they're losing crops. They're having the thin margin of modern agriculture whittled away by these wild animals on the landscape. Other people are shockingly unaware. I mean, I did a series of events in the Mission Valley and in bear country, and there are people, you know, we can look at collar data and see that these bears are in someone's backyard. And then you talk to them and they say to you, I had no idea that grizzlies were in this area.
And your job one summer is to keep the bears out of this farmer's cornfield by building a fence around it, an electric fence.
It's the kind of place where you really wouldn't expect to see a grizzly bear. But in this case, the cornfield provides, unfortunately, this almost irresistible source of late season food for the bears.
They love it.
They love it, but it's very bad for them because at a time when they should be up in the peaks, feeding on these big colonies of insects that actually nest in the high mission range, they're instead down on the valley floor eating this carbohydrate-rich, fairly unhealthy crop that puts them in conflict with people.
And the fence kind of worked, and it also kind of didn't, right? I mean, like, why didn't that fence, the shock of it, keep those bears out of the cornfield?
There are a lot of reasons for that, and I think probably the primary one has to do with the individuality and inventiveness of these animals. They were looking for every single way in or out of this cornfield because they were so used to having it for about a decade. So, for instance, an irrigation ditch would go dry one night. They would slip under in that muddy canal and get into the field just like that. I think the other part of it has to do with, as I mentioned before, the razor-thin margins of modern agriculture. So the corn farmer who was raising this crop, he doesn't have the time or the resources to commit to maintaining the fence, which makes it very hard to make it a perfect solution.
So over the course of the summer, you're building this fence. You also discover that someone in the area has shot one of these bears. Her name is Millie. mm-hmm. and you become almost haunted by what happened to this animal. Can you explain how her fate became mixed up with the humans in the Mission Valley?
It boils down to the placement of this cornfield and the draw of the crop. So just above the cornfield in the foothills of the Mission Range is a place called Millie's Woods. It's the grove that this particular bear is named after. That grove is some of the densest occupied grizzly habitat in the lower 48. So it's a natural place for bears to congregate. And from that location, you can actually see into this cornfield. Hmm. So it's a very natural progression to come to the edge of the foothills that way. And this cornfield was providing a perfect kind of a gateway drug to being comfortable around humans, which was eventually her unmaking.
And you knew she was injured because there were game cameras around this fence in the cornfield. But the fascinating thing about this book is that you didn't actually come across Millie or any bear, really, in this book until it was almost over. But I got the sense that you kind of wanted to.
Certainly. And I can't fully explain or entirely defend that because there were moments when I look back on them. These were the times when, like, my grandmother would hear about it and threaten to stop praying for me if I didn't cut it out. But there was this very real desire to be near them, to understand them, to have the bears on the landscape, to come close to them and to encounter them. It really changes the way you look at the world. I mean, for me, I felt that it sharpened my senses and it gave me a sense of perspective, of some kind of understanding of a time when we existed in a world that exceeded our species.
And what about the people living around this farm? Did they worry about the fact that these animals were there? Did they kind of do things to stop them from coming into their space?
I think that's a really good point to raise. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit for us to pick in the landscape in terms of improving the way we coexist with these animals. So if somebody's leaving out hides, if somebody's leaving out unsecured garbage, or they have chickens that are not behind an electric fence, we know that those things are going to lead to dead bears. So there are a lot of these very practical things that we have to do as we look at this extremely important moment in the recovery of the species.
Millie had two cubs that she abandoned after she was injured so badly. Mm-hmm. They survived, but that's only because they were captured, brought into captivity, and eventually sent to the Baltimore Zoo.
Correct.
Are those cubs better off in captivity for the rest of their life? Or would they be better off perishing like their mother did?
That is a very good question. I still don't know which would be better for the cubs, but I think I know what's better for us. I believe that to the extent that it's possible, any sort of emotional, individual, personal connection that we can forge between human beings in the modern world and animals like the grizzly is of vital importance. I know those cubs will not enjoy being in a zoo, but what I hope is that people will form meaningful relationships with them, which will cause them to care about the species.
But you do have a tough task in front of you. I want to play part of an interview that I did in 2016 with a Wyoming rancher near Yellowstone. His name was Nick Patrick, and he'd been mauled by a female grizzly while working on his land.
And so the first thing she did was reach up and bite me in the face, you know, and then it was just a melee from there. And she at one point grabbed me by my left knee and drug me about 20 feet and bit me through the hand, and then she finally decided she'd, I guess, taught me a lesson, and she took off.
Now, I play that, you know, not to be sensational, but because on the one hand, these are majestic animals who were living on this land long before we were. On the other, they do have this power to do a tremendous amount of damage, and it's your job to convince us, right, that both of these species can live together.
Yeah, I think it is my job to explore that relationship as deeply as I can and to look at it honestly, because I feel for him. I'm afraid of that outcome. I mean, that's a terror. I've had nightmares about it. At the same time, I want to highlight how infrequently that happens for the number of humans and bears that are on the landscape. And in the course of my encounter with bears, I felt a huge measure of fear. I've also felt extremely lucky and humbled. And I actually think that those three emotions are good things for human beings to be feeling, probably always, but certainly in our present moment.
Bryce Andrews, his new book is Down from the Mountain, The Life and Death of a Grizzly Bear. Bryce, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I spoke with Bryce Andrews in April 2019.